So I work on a computer a lot at work. I'm on a computer for hours on end. So, but it's good because I can listen to Spotify while I'm working, and
You can listen to your favorite podcasts and other stuff podcasts.
absolutely not. Absolutely not what I'm listening to. Nor is it my favorite podcast, I'll say it.
RIP, dude. Yeah, honestly,
Just
I do
kidding.
not like listening to my own voice at all. It's very
Yeah,
hard.
yeah. No, I've been listening to the Beatles a lot. I listened to like
Okay.
four Beatles albums at work
Respect.
on end. Man, they're good. And I was kind of like, we talked about this with La La Land, where like when it first came out, it was so popular that I was like, oh, this isn't good. I've always been in a club, Beatles are overrated, dude, but I never listened to the Beatles. Like, I mean, I have listened to the Beatles, but like not in depth. And I've been listening to them. Holy cow, they're good. Because the first couple albums are like, or the first album is not that different from like other stuff you hear in the 60s. It's pretty straightforward, but it's like, dude, like Twist and Shout. Wow. I don't even know if that was their original song, but look, all
Wow,
I'm saying is,
it took
what?
you this long to figure out that they're good.
No, again, it was, I think in, I knew they were always good, but I didn't want to admit it, I guess. See, I always preferred the Stones, but now I'm like way on Beatles' side. It's like the Stones are without a doubt good, but just like there's something incredible about what they do. Like it's so like their song titles are nuts, and like some of their songs are just about random people. I don't know, man. And they have, I think, like the argument I would always use was like they have so much music and so many songs that they have quite a few bad songs, and it only makes sense that like they have some amazing songs. But I don't think that's fair because like the songs that are amazing are like some of the best songs of all time. And like some of the most timeless songs of all time. And they're not afraid of like releasing like a minute and a half song that's just perfect. And like it reminds me a lot of releasing like an hour and a half movie that's like perfect, like the movie we're going to talk about today. But I didn't even mean for that to segue, honestly.
Oh,
But yeah,
dude.
much respect to the Beatles. I'm sorry that I didn't give you your full credit.
So, wow. You really just that was a smooth line right there. A lot of
What can
perfect
I say, man?
songs that are nice, short, and sweet, just like the one we're talking about today. How about that? I will say we are recording this episode on the great holiday of July the 4th.
Happy fourth, everyone.
It's very exciting. Today we celebrate the, let's see, how many years would it be? I guess it would be
Today we celebrate Joey
25.
Chestnut breaking his record once
Yes,
again.
yes,
I don't know
yes, dude.
this. I'm sorry.
Yes, dude. He has 13 championships, the most in any professional sport.
I'm tired of hearing about Tiger Woods and LeBron.
He's passed Bill Russell. Bill Russell had 11 in the NBA. Joey Chestnut now has 13. Tied for the most. I forget who's tied with, but tied for the most in a any kind of championship in any sport. So
A true glizzy gobbler.
yes. But today we celebrate the 25th anniversary of Will Smith saving our planet from an alien invasion from the classic 1996 American science fiction action film Independence Day. Shout out
you like that
Will
movie?
Smith. I mean, yeah, it's a good one.
Did you see the new one?
I've seen bits and pieces. I heard it was not super
I never watched it. The old
good.
one's cool. The old one's cool.
Good old
I
Jeff
love Jeff Goldblum.
Goldblum.
Yeah.
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 But yeah,
That's the real
I
reason
feel
to celebrate today.
a timeless classic. Thank you, Will Smith, for saving our planet. I feel like that's a good intro, I think. Do you
Yeah,
have
it's an awesome
anything else to
intro.
report? I don't know.
No, nothing, absolutely nothing.
No. All right.
Yeah, we're gonna roll ad and we'll be right back with 12 Angry Men. All right, welcome back. this week we're discussing 12 Angry Men, 1957, Sidney Lumet.
Yes, please give me all of the background information on the crew, the cast. When was it released?
Me?
No, I'm what? No, I'm not mocking you.
No, yeah, released 1957. I picked this movie because of Sidney Lumet. I liked that we got Scorsese and the Coens and Spielberg and the Russo brothers. You know, all mm-hmm. these incredible
yep,
directors.
Yeah. And a little bit of spoilers. We're having Tarantino and Shane Nolan, right?
Yeah,
to close out the season.
I was joking about the Russo brothers, by the way.
Well, hey, come on.
Okay, anyway.
Come on.
So, yeah, Sidney Lumet. I want to include Sidney Lumet.
Bro.
He directed Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, The Verdict, Network. Is probably his most famous. And yeah, 12 Angry Men. I don't know why I'm so partial to the 50s. I think I watched so much stuff as a kid from the 40s and 50s. And I like Network. It's supposed to be his best movie. I like The Verdict as well, Dog Day Afternoon. But I don't know. It's something about 12 Angry Men I love. So yeah, I wanted to include Sidney Lumet. He's big at NYU. He's big in the film school. Like,
real
lots of
big.
Lessons
yep.
that come from him.
Yep.
Yeah. Him and Scorsese a lot. But yeah, Aiden, do you have any initial thoughts? Enjoyment scale? Where would you put it compared to the rest?
Yeah. Man, I'll tell you, Michael, you are just exposing me to all kinds of great films and all kinds of different areas of the film universe. I will say in my rankings, I'd say 12 Angry Men is probably middle of the pack.
Once again, we got a middle of the pack movie.
Thanks
for that detail.
Now, I will say middle of the pack, but probably near the front of the middle.
Nice.
And like we addressed last week, just because we've seen so many films, I'm honestly last episode, like it's going to be quite the challenge to try and rank all the films.
Mm-hmm.
Especially once you get near the top. So I'm interested for that. I'm excited for that
for me too.
But also to hear what yours are.
Ready for this to be over. Just want to get there.
Yes, I'm season 4. Please end. Golly.
Just please end.
yeah, 12 Angry Men. Thought I wasn't going to like it, honestly. I guess when was Dial In for Murder? That was the 50s as well, right?
Yeah, I can't remember if it's 54 or 58.
Yeah. I think I don't know, because I thought I was going to not like that one as well, but I guess it's just a 50s vibe for me to walk in expecting to not like it, but I enjoyed it, I would say. It was interesting because I remember...
Wait, but you liked Dial In for Murder.
Yeah, I did.
So you walked into this movie, another 50s movie, expecting not to like it, and you liked Singing in the Rain, also from the 50s.
Right, I'm saying I walked into all three expecting to not like them.
Right, but I'm saying you walked into this one knowing it's from the 50s, having seen two movies in the
50s.
Yeah,
yeah, okay, okay, okay. All right, I get it.
I'm just saying.
Okay.
I'm just asking.
No need to criticize me, okay?
No, I'm not criticizing you. I'm just, I'm sorry. I was trying to be clear, but it's okay.
Yeah, so walked in expecting not to like it. And I think what may have been different this time was because it was in black and white, which the other two 50s films were not. And I think I was, not that there's anything wrong with black and white. I think, you know, there's, you know, a lot of cool artistic things you can do with that. And there's certainly a lot of good films that are in black and white. But I think it just kind of takes the opportunity to talk about color and you know, that sort of thing out the window, especially when, like, 2 weeks ago we talked about the insane variety and use of color in La La Land. And so I guess the black and white was kind of turning me off a little bit.
For the entire movie or just walking
No,
in?
just to start. I think I got used to it, and I was fine with it by the end. But overall, interesting film. You know, one of the last things I wrote down is I should probably save it for later. This is a good point, but I'll just go ahead and use it. I think that just the way that the film was shot, I mean, you have one tiny scene in the courtroom, but the majority of the film is, you know, basically a continuous shot. It's not a continuous shot, but it, you know, it kind of is, of just 12 guys in a room sitting around a table. And you have, you know, brief little scenes where they walk in the bathroom or at the end when they walk outside or whatever. But I think this film is a great example of, you know, film doesn't have to be this huge glamorous thing. It doesn't have to be this huge money industry. Like, you don't have to have a ton of money to make a film. You just need a room with a table and 12 guys and a good story, and anything can turn out good, you know.
I said something very similar. Yeah.
Yeah. How about that?
Yeah.
But yeah, overall, super interesting. It felt like every shot that was in the film was different than the last one, and they almost didn't reuse anything. I'm sure that they did at some point, but I didn't seem to catch it. And there were no names of characters. Didn't really need them, really. I mean, well, you had the interaction it's with the two at the end. But, yeah, I know. Perfect. Juror 7. And,
do you know Henry Fonda's name? The main guy's name?
Yeah, juror 7, right? Or is it 8?
8.
Yeah, it's 8.
Okay. Do you know his real name?
Yeah, it's Henry Fonda.
No. No, it doesn't matter. His name in the movie that they say at the end.
Yeah, they say at the end. It's, I don't know.
Sorry,
it wasn't important. It wasn't important.
Yeah, right. It wasn't important.
But yeah, no names is great for me, as we've learned. But just another, like, cool thing to add in that you don't even need a story with people that have names, you know, to tell a good story. And last cool thing, I'll let you hop in. We never saw the guy that they were discussing, but by the end of the story, we're able to picture, you know, what this guy is like, potentially what he looks like if you are imaginative enough, and, you know, what his life is like without leaving that jury room, which is just incredible storytelling, and really, really well done in the film.
Yeah, yeah, I'll jump in. We do see the guy.
Just kidding.
In the first scene. Yeah, you see him. He's the kid. He's the Hispanic kid.
Okay.
Crying.
I think I was writing down a note when that came up, and I just didn't think anything of it. So I apologize, everyone. false information. Maybe I should gather my facts and evidence before coming with a good argument. So.
It's all good. Yeah, I know. I feel like I miss a lot when I write notes. Like, okay. Anyway, so, yeah, your comment about color, that's true. I guess there's less color to talk about, but I don't think that the lack of color does not take away from this movie. I'll say that.
Yeah, I agree. It's just like, in comparison to what else we're doing.
It's different. I prefer black and white to color.
Interesting.
If I could shoot everything from here on out in black and white, I feel like I would.
Mm.
It's easier. It's prettier. It's, oh man, I love it. But it's. I think that obviously color has its place. You know, Singing in the Rain would not be the same without color, or La La Land, or Dialing for Murder even. But I think to suggest a movie like this, or a similar movie like Failsafe, or The French New Wave, or German expressionism or noir, you know, like it's black and white without a doubt has its place as well, you know, and emphasizes lighting above color. Like that's one of the like practices of sight and sound is to eliminate color so that we can focus intensely on light and what it's doing and how it's shaping. And that's the basics of photography, you know, is how to use light to shape your picture and not focus too much on anything else. And so, yeah, I thought beautifully shot, some really interesting stuff with lights. Yeah, I mean, I have a lot to say about the cinematography as a start. I mean, the cinematography was done by Boris Kaufman. He's also responsible for On the Waterfront, also black and white. What did I write down about cinematography? Where is that?
Bro, I don't know. Why?
No, I haven't. No, I do know. It's simple but impactful is what I said. It's not easy to keep an hour and a half movie in the same room interesting. And you said that like every shot felt new. I think I agree with that. It's very thoughtful framing. There were repeated stuff, but you don't feel like they're repeated, you know? It's an hour and a half of conversation. There are movies made today that a minute and a half conversation isn't something that you want to sit through, and it gets boring by the end of that scene. And that's a testament to this movie has great writing, written by Reginald Rose, who is a playwright and an author and a screenwriter. Actually, there's such a thing as 12 Angry Women, is what I found, which was a play based off of the movie, written a few years after by the same writer, Reginald Rose. But I mean, again, like it being interesting for an hour and a half is a testament to good writing, good cinematography, and good directing, good performances, really good performances. There's such good framing with characters. You have the one jury member who talked about growing up in a slum, and he was one of the original guys that switched over to Not Guilty in the movie, one of the first guys. And he's like introduced as kind of impressionable, softer spoken, and they're talking about like growing up in a slum, and the more racist character is talking, the old guy who keeps coughing keeps talking about how like you know what kind of a person this is, he's obviously guilty, and they frame it up in a way that it shows the person that old guy's talking to, but it also shows the guy from the slum, and it's effective, and it adds nerves to this frame that wouldn't have been there if it just showed a conversation between two people. And I think a lot of movies you watch are so quick to just show a conversation between two people, but by adding context and putting this guy in a chair next to them, it adds so much tension and so much more meaning to a pretty simple conversation. There's a lot of great blocking to break up the scenes that are just straight conversation. You have moments where everyone gets up from the table and walks around, and people go to the bathroom, and people are moving around, hanging up a coat, turning on the fan, trying to turn on the fan, that kind of thing. And you have great shots of moving camera, very effective reaction shots, I found, dramatic portraits of characters, especially Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb, who was like the main antagonist, who rips out the picture of his child. Every time Henry Fonda is countered by something or like kind of put in his place by something someone says, which only happens a couple times, it shows his face in like a very effective reaction shot. And then they do this great eye light that's kind of coming from above and illuminates like a line on their face, and it's I don't know quite the effect that it has, but it's like angelic almost. It's like shows an idea almost in their eyes. And there's a moment when Lee J. Cobb starts talking about his kids, his son he hasn't seen in 2 years, and how all kids are the same, you know, the bitterness that he holds. And you see Henry Fonda understand this character. You see him begin to understand like why he feels the way he does about the trial, and he's so hell-bent on getting this guy convicted. And it's just very effective moments by simply showing a character's face. They don't have to be doing anything special, but mixed with the directing and the performances and just picking those shots, was very effective. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very effective. Yeah, great shots of singling people out. You'll have the camera rotating around these conversations, and then all of a sudden it'll break off and show a character in a quiet, alone moment. This was really effective for Henry Fonda when he was kind of taking a minute to retreat and think about things. There was a moment in the movie when he was kind of getting ready to like submit before anyone was really being swayed, and you have a quiet moment with him where he goes and stands by the window or by the water cooler, and there's a little bit of music, and it just conveys a feeling without any words. What's going through the character's head. But yeah, that was just, that's not really cinematography, that's a lot of directing. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of shots that I enjoyed. They were all kind of a tad similar to one another. One of them being the opening shot, where we are finding our way to the courtroom, where we're kind of following these random people that you may think are the main characters, and then, you know, someone walks in front of the person, and then the camera starts following the new person. Up until we get to the courtroom, just really, you know, you could have just done a straight walk down the hallway up to the courtroom, and probably would have gotten the same point across. But I think it just adds to the level of beauty in the cinematography. And additionally, there was a little bit in the jury room when everyone was making their first arguments, just going one by one. They start with juror number one. He gives his little spiel, and then the camera like picks itself up and then slides down the table to jury number two. Mm-hmm. And then it just does the same thing up till five or six or whenever they start to stop. And then I think, something similar happened in the, jury room as the opening scene. And I think it was just like for a little brief moment, just the camera is following someone, and then someone walks in front of that person, and the camera follows the new person, which is just a super fascinating, you know, use of camera movement, that I really enjoyed throughout those few moments. So,
yeah, I'll also talk about the opening because it's simple. Again, it's a simple movie. It's, you're right. It's adds so much intrigue and interest when you walk into the building and there's people celebrating their trial going well, and then you follow them, and the guy hushes them and opens the courtroom door, and then you have a trial that isn't going so well for someone. So it totally flips that on its head immediately. Yeah. The courtroom doesn't need to be explained, and this is apparent through the judge's demeanor. It's like you have this judge talking through this trial. We don't even see the accused yet. We just see the judge explaining before he retires the jury, you know, what the process is going to look like. And he's very nonchalant about it. And it's like he's said this thing 100 times, because he has, obviously. But he is in the same mindset of a lot of the jurors of, okay, this kid's guilty, let's get this over with. It's a great introduction to the characters, scrolling through, you know, the camera panning along all of them. And the final shot, I guess you can't attest to this, but the shot of the accused on the stand, or not on the stand, but the shot of the accused, and man, it like there's some beautiful portrait work of close-ups on faces in this movie. And he's got tears in his eyes, and there's that light I was talking about, the eye light coming from above. And it's really powerful, and it's a powerful face that you remember for the rest of the movie. And for me, I think about that shot. Sorry, I mean, I guess you just don't have the same experience as me. But that shot.
Yeah, clearly I remember it for the rest of the,
rest of the film. That shot is so effective. And every time they're talking about this kid and what a monster he is, or that quote-unquote they're all the same, and all these things, you think about this kid, and it's all you needed is one simple shot of the kid sitting there to have that image in your head the rest of the movie. And that just, I was talking about earlier, like simple shots that establish so much by putting a character next to another character during a certain like conversation. It's just stuff like that is so well done. That's what keeps it interesting and effective. The opening lines in the chamber are so, they introduce all the characters, and it's not expositional. It's not, there are a couple that do say what they do for a living, but that's not like that important. It's, yeah, it's just really interesting dialogue. You have the guy in the baseball who wants to go to the baseball game, who's chewing gum, and you know, it's clear what kind of a person he is, that he's not that invested in the trial. Mm-hmm. You have the guy that's coughing, the racist guy, who makes a joke about electing the kid senator after they vote for his execution, or for the verdict. You have Lee J. Cobb, who talks about starting with nothing, and now he has like 37 workers at his plant.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about needing to get kids in line and how, you know, kids are all the same. And it just introduces the character well. And you have the guy with the glasses, the stockbroker. Oh, no, different character. You have the guy with glasses who works at the ad agency, who's very amused by the whole thing. He's kind of treating everything like a joke. Mm-hmm. The skinny guy from the slums I was talking about earlier, he seems very impressionable, nervous. I don't know what my handwriting says there.
Classic.
He doesn't want to talk about his reasoning for the guilty verdict. He says, "Can I pass?" when they're all going around. It's like these things are all telling about these characters.
Yeah.
And then you have Henry Fonda, the elderly man, and the European guy who don't really participate in all the banter and people joking around. They're all more serious. And those are like the first three people, or within the first five people, to switch their vote to not guilty. So it's like these things are all telling of the type of people they are. And I'll just continue on this by saying that the antagonist is such a good one. And you have the antagonistic force in a couple of people. You have it through Lee J. Cobb, who's kind of the main antagonistic force. And you also have it through the stockbroker. And I don't even really count the racist guy as an antagonist, because he doesn't hold any power in this room. And I think that was really well established. I'll talk a lot more about that later. But the stockbroker is pretty arrogant, but he's very analytical and thoughtful about his case and like mm-hmm. why he thinks he's guilty. Lee J. Cobb isn't quite as arrogant as the others, I don't feel. But he does really seem to care about his point of view. He has notes written down, so he's not quite as flippant about it as a lot of the other people in the room. He has notes. It seems that he cares, which in my mind makes him more of a, like a worthy adversary for Henry Fonda in this room. And as opposed to just the racist guy or other characters like the guy playing baseball or the guy wanting to go to the baseball game who like obviously had no case in it. Lee J. Cobb was also very sentimental, talks about his kids, and that's a clear-cut reason for why he wants the kid to be convicted, is because of like a very personal reason. So I thought a very effective a very effective antagonist.
Yeah, I was gonna also, is there someone like yelling outside your place?
Yeah, it happens, you know. Yeah, I think I've learned New York to tune thing. It out. Yeah,
it's fine. Yeah, all right. Just wanted to confirm that was happening. Okay.
So. Yeah, it was not my roommate.
Cool. Thank goodness. I'd be worried. You kind of touched on it. Introduction of characters. Everyone's a little different. And I think you may have hit on it, but I don't think you explicitly said. I think each introduction of the character, every character basically presents their own flaw or like their own soft spot in their, you know, their argument, whether that be their actual argument or just their personality or the way that they hop around the subject or don't want to talk about the subject. Like, I think juror number 4 passes on his turn, just because he doesn't want to talk about it, I guess. The first one is just like super nervous about everything and kind of gave me vibes of just, you know, whoever in the jury room has the better argument is the guy that he's going to, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
he'll believe. And I think the guy that wanted to go home, you know, obviously there's a chance that he can be swayed either way, depending on, you know, which side has the most votes, because whatever that is, you know, he gets to go home earlier. Just a lot of, you know, different personalities in the room, a lot of people doing, you know, different professions, people with different life experiences. And I think all of that added together just goes to show that Henry Fonda knows how to work people, and knows how to, you know, present a good argument that, you know, kind of make people realize that. It's interesting that this morning, actually, I'm reading a book that I it's literally taken me forever to get through, but it's by Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And it's literally just a book about how to deal with people, how to, you know, deal with certain situations with people to, you know, avoid conflict and, you know, come to an agreement on things.
Is it working?
And I mean, I'm trying to implement it. It's like hard to, you know, there's like a lot of things in the book that are very hard to just like straight up start implementing, but it's really interesting to actually see those things start to work in daily life. But I'm like, it's crazy because I could definitely see that in Henry Fonda's character, of just knowing how to work people. And you know, those two guys that were yelling the whole time. I mean, obviously Henry Fonda didn't raise his voice or yell, you know, maybe he did once, but you know, he really just knew how to present some evidence and then let the other people work their way into the not guilty verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, creating conflict, there's, you know, you're just dividing people more by everyone just starting to yell at each other. So by, you know, presenting a counterpoint and just letting other people work their way to that, is one of the best ways to get people to come to an agreement on something. I can definitely see that in him. Another cool thing, you could tell a lot about the jurors, not by what they said, but how they said it. Kind of touched on that. But you know, the first impressions we get of the jurors, it doesn't really matter what they say about the case or whatever. It's just, you know, how they say it that, you know, we as an audience, but also Henry Fonda is the only guy that votes not guilty at the beginning. You know, that's how he's able to find out his way of going about this and trying to convince people otherwise. Very interesting guy.
Totally. No, I have you've said a lot of things that I have written down. I'm just trying to gather. There's a lot about arguing and winning people over and that sort of thing that you're talking about. Did you know that juror number two, the guy that you said would kind of be on, the nervous guy who kind of would be on whatever side, did you ever watch Winnie the Pooh?
I mean, I'm sure I did, but I don't really remember anything.
He is Piglet's voice.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I could see that. His voice was pretty high pitched.
But yeah, there is so much about, you're right, like about, sometimes it is what they say as well, too. It's like the moment that sticks out is the guy with the fedora just switching his vote because he thinks he'll be faster and he'll be able to go to his baseball game. It's like, the way that these characters handled themselves, like Lee J. Cobb was far more worthy than a couple other guys around the table, not because of what he thought, because he was very biased in his opinion, but he did in a way care adamantly about it. And that goes a long way. Mm-hmm. There's a lot like more to break down there, but you know, like, there's meaning behind, you know, Henry Fonda went out walking the night after the first, I guess, a previous night, and bought a knife at the drugstore. He went to the kid's neighborhood and walked around and witnessed it. Like, this just shows, beyond any other person at the table, that he cared more than them because he did go out and experience it. That's how much he's been thinking about the trial. It's even clear from him staying next to the window for the entire opening scene and saying nothing. He's probably the last person in the room that you hear a word from. I think that's telling as well. I talked about how you kind of hear less from the people that have a lot to say. The stockbroker with glasses, the European guy, the more elderly man, and Henry Fonda. Like, these are the characters you hear from the least.
Mm-hmm.
And juror number four. And I mean, yeah, there's a lot through the dialogue, through creative writing, as well as just through images. And I kind of skipped this. You talked about this already, but I agree that it's... Oh, maybe I didn't skip it. Yeah, I did not skip it. Here it is. You talked about this already. It is a simple set. It's literally a room on a soundstage with a picture of a city through the window. Like, that's how simple it is. Yeah, it's such a good story with such great acting, with such great directing and cinematography that's all you need. It's very difficult. I think, like, film students are always racking their brain for, like, what can I do in my apartment? What can I do that's not going to cost any money? And it's really difficult. And you see projects that it's like, wow, that did not cost that much money. That's so good. It's all about the idea. When you have a good enough idea, you know, that doesn't cost a lot of money, because this did not cost that much to build this set.
Yeah.
Your budget can go to the talent, to the rehearsal, to, you know, making sure that set looks good, which it did, you know, and your energy can go elsewhere besides worrying about massive set pieces. And it goes both ways, because then you have, you know, a movie like we're going to watch next week, or Lawrence of Arabia, or these massive epic movies that are good on the opposite end. But it's very telling that it's good filmmaking when it's something this simple and it works so well. And we already talked about how it keeps your attention from minute one to, you know, 1:36 or whatever, or an hour 36 rather.
Yeah.
I
just wanted to add in, you mentioned that the four guys that were voting not guilty, they didn't really have to say much. Really, it was just like Fonda at the beginning plans to see that he's not guilty. He makes a few more points throughout the entire plot that kind of keep it moving. But really, just after someone switches their vote from guilty to not guilty, that person, you know, obviously, you know, they have to explain themselves, I feel like, especially with a majority of them saying guilty. And so through that, Henry Fonda basically doesn't have to do any work. It's just the people that are flipping, they explain themselves, and then, you know, something arises where they, you know, think about some scenario, and then it ends up flipping someone else, and that person, you know, it kind of felt like a cycle, and then every once in a while, Fonda jumps back in, gives a good point. One of the... shoot, what was I going to say? Every, like, argument that there was... They were finding like a weak point in someone and trying to get them to flip. And the ones that I can think of right off the top of my head, the knife, and just like how they test the motion of stabbing, downwards on someone that's like completely taller than you, it ends up being a switchblade, and no one handles a switchblade with the knife pointing away from the thumb.
Yeah.
And so, that one flips someone, and then also the indent on the nose from glasses, that flips someone, the guy that actually had glasses. And then there was another one that I remember that I don't remember.
Reenacting the hallway.
Yes, that one. That wasn't what I was thinking of earlier, but that was a good one as well. And then also, unrelated, I actually looked up what the budget was for this film. It was somewhere in the $850,000 ballpark, which
It's
today.
Which, I mean, is obviously more than
right. today is around $8.5 million, which is still like
super low.
Yeah, super cheap for a film, especially one of, you know, this quality, I would say. Which is interesting. Like, I don't know. I don't know if any of these guys in this film are super famous. I feel like Henry Fonda has to be.
Henry Fonda, Lee J. Cobb, they were all pretty established. Not all, they're not all massive, but like there were a couple around the table that were pretty established. Right. Yeah.
So I would say, you know, with a set being like that, like you said, you're able to open things up quite a bit with the casting. And, you know, even if your story is good, you still need good talent to pull it through. And so with a super low cost set and a good story, you can really open it up with your actors. And seemingly they did, because the story was portrayed very well.
And there's something to be said about, I think, talent being willing to make a low budget movie for like a great director. You know, it's, you know, Sidney Lumet went on to make even more acclaimed movies for the next 20 something years. But when it is this good of a story and this great of a director, it's, you know, there's something about, you know, an actor that's probably willing, to do this kind of movie for less money. And that also is just a testament to like the quality of work, I think. I got a few other things I can list off here.
I'll just add one more thing about character. Thanks to Amazon's little trivia notes, shout out again, pointed out that Henry Fonda's character was the only person wearing a white suit in the room. Everyone else was wearing a black or blue or gray or whatever. And he was the only one, I think he was also the only one that didn't take his jacket off, if I remember correctly. That was to continue the point, like to make a point of it. But I looked up what white represents in films. Keywords that I found: love, protection, peace, and innocence. And I underlined innocence several times. And just interesting, like, even when there's no color in the film, you're still able to tell a story with color, which is crazy. Being in black and white, it's literally just two colors, and still you're able to tell a story with the color, which is just super, super crazy and fascinating.
I think you don't need, like, without even looking up the, like, what those colors mean, it's like, it's just clear that there's something to it, you know, about like the white suit compared to the rest. I thought passage of time was achieved well. It's not super clear how long we're in there, but like they skip time a couple times very seamlessly. You don't really notice. I had a note here that says that long takes are underrated. And I think, like, long takes are kind of in vogue. I guess that started, I don't know. I mean, I know there's one movie that's from, like, the 80s. Yeah, like, I feel like Alejandro Iñárritu and, like, Alfonso Cuarón, like, kind of established it with, like, Birdman. I'm forgetting the name of the movie, The Revenant, Children of Men, like these like long take movies. And then like obviously 1917, Sam Mendes, it's like you have like something really popular. It's like, oh, hold the camera longer and it's like cooler, or like it's harder to do. And there's truth to that. There is truth to that, because like there's some crazy things that they do in these movies. But then like there's also just like there are times I've found recently where like a long take is just like you're doing a long take for the sake of it. And not only are you doing a long take for the sake of it, you're also stitching together like takes so that it's no longer like about having an actor do their thing for a long time, but now, okay, we'll just stitch it together here. And there's, I mean, it's not all bad. It's not what I'm saying at all, but it's, I think you don't think about, like, even when it's not like a full movie in one take, like 1917, or like a full 5-minute scene, there are moments in this movie that might be 2 minutes without a cut, that is just a lot of dialogue, a lot of acting that doesn't get boring, and it's it's impressive. Like one that sticks out to me is the long take of, I guess it's juror number 10, the racist guy, who is ranting at the table, and everyone stands up and leaves. And that's just one long take of everyone doing that and then returning back to the table. It's a long shot. And you've got a few other shots of, like, you got the shot at the beginning of everyone walking around the table and finding their seats and putting their jackets away and standing at the window. And it's just, like, very well rehearsed and very well blocked. And there's, like, a lot of impressive work achieved with the long take. It also does a good job, a long take, of establishing environment and establishing location. This is a pretty easy location to establish. It's just one room where everyone's sitting around a table in order as well. But the environment's established very well. My favorite, one of my favorite frames of the movie is after he reenacts the hallway and times it, everyone's like kind of becoming intrigued, like, oh, maybe it wasn't possible that he was seeing the hallway. And 11 of the jurors are all standing in one frame. And I counted. I was like, okay, there's 11 there. One of them's missing. And then Lee J. Cobb is standing over to the other end. And that's when Lee J. Cobb becomes violent and attacks Henry Fonda, and they have to hold him back. But they just establish so well that Henry Fonda has achieved something here and, like, has gotten everyone interested in his point. Mm-hmm. And all 11 of them are crowded into one frame. Like, and that's pretty rare for this movie, for all 11 of them to, like, be in such a tight, focused area. And then it shows an over the shoulder of all 11 of them and Lee J. Cobb sitting on the other end of the room saying that doesn't prove anything. And just very effective framing. It's very Kurosawa-esque of them to they use movement and stature and characters placed in a frame to emphasize the attitude of what's going on. They emphasize Lee J. Cobb being alone by making everyone crowd around and become interested in Henry Fonda. And that's the big moment of everyone's beginning to see that the guilty verdict is maybe not the way to go. And that's the point when they're slowly whittling people off one by one of, okay, everyone's becoming a little bit weaker. I thought Lee J. Cobb's arc is a very powerful one. He's the last one to switch to not guilty. And the second that he feels remorse for ripping up the picture of his son is when he realizes not guilty. Mm-hmm. The first time that he's softened, he's very hardened. He talks about literally beating his son into a man, his son then leaving for 2 years. Mm-hmm. He's very much stern and serious. But he's softened at one moment in the movie when he rips up the picture of his son. He feels sorry about that. And he immediately says not guilty. And that's just such an effective picture, I thought.
Yeah, I think going off that, if I remember correctly, after, you know, everyone makes their final case or whatever, and he's still stuck on guilty, he kind of just yells himself into being not guilty.
Yeah, like, he rants for a couple minutes and then rips out the picture. Yeah,
right. And it was just so fat, like, I don't know that I was paying that much attention to it, but I still noticed it where he was just talking and yelling and ranting and no one was giving him affirmation. No one was arguing with him. They just, like, all of them believed themselves and, you know, were standing their ground and knew that eventually the guy had to crack, whether that be him actually believing that the guy is not guilty or, you know, him just wanting to give up and leave. But it was just so interesting that everyone just just lets him do his thing and talk himself right into it. And it's just super cool storytelling. You could have definitely just had someone, you know, tack on another 5 minutes and have some kind of argument or have another piece of evidence being worked against him. But just having him come to that realization himself, I think, makes it so much better.
Yeah, totally. Anything else?
Like, do you have anything else, or are you just asking?
Yeah, I'm gonna go into themes, but I figured we'd close with that, or I can do it now, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, this might be long. I don't know. so we'll go. it's
he says this might be long as we've already hit a long episode, but
oh, dude, not
super long. Come on, we still got a while.
Dude, we could go for an hour and I'd still be okay.
But we just want to spare our listeners, you know.
No, I don't. I don't care. If you guys want to listen this long, you listen this long. If you don't, turn it off. You're not...
Yikes, man. Wow, all right.
Bro, it doesn't matter.
Please.
Okay. I'm sorry, guys. Please listen. Please listen. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's... yeah, the movie is a lesson of empathy, ethics, how to treat others, and yourself. It's... Did you do speech and debate in high school?
No, we did not have a speech and debate team.
Okay.
Actually, so we may have, I don't know.
We had a required rhetoric class in my school where you had to do speeches and you had half the semester was debating or whatever. And we watched this movie in that class, I remember. And I was super excited about that, like, oh, we get to watch 12 Angry Men in class. Awesome. But anyway, it's interesting that we watched this in that class because debating in my high school, and I think I've even seen some high-level debating high school debaters, that the argument gets a little bit heated, and it's not just about ethics and reasoning. It can become personal really quickly. Mm-hmm. And the focus of debate class for me, like in all the debates I was in, always felt so calculated and like regimented, not personal at all, and just all about facts. And I think that that's fine, and I think facts are important without a doubt. But I think like what this movie shows is like, you, in order to convince someone of something, or in order to like show someone the right way, we often have to be empathetic and ethical and loving, in addition to being factual and having substantiated evidence. We see a lot in this movie, including racism, xenophobia. Lee J. Cobb has a lot of built-up bitterness that's, you know, controlling the way he's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of guys around the table just are making assumptions about the convicted, and that's why they have chosen the way they think. But there's one character that looks past that and is willing to stand up and say, okay, well, wait, he might not be guilty, and that's enough to free him of this potentially, or give him another trial at the very least. And that's achieved through like caring about other people. Like we said it, this whole podcast is like, it was clear that Henry Fonda cared about the convicted more mm-hmm. than anyone else at the table. You know, he went walking in his neighborhood, walked in his shoes a bit, bought the knife, stands at the window thinking about the case, isn't participating in the banter. Same with the European juror number 11, I guess. Or 10. Maybe.
It was 11.
Juror number 11 was the ad agency guy.
No, he was 12.
Oh, right, because I was thinking the guy at the head of the table was 12. Yes, okay, yeah, 11.
Please,
juror number 11,
gather your facts. Also, golly.
Yeah. Juror number 11, like, also cared a lot. There was ageism as well, a bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
The old man was a lot more perceptive about a lot of things that happened in the courtroom, including, like, the eyeglasses thing,
mm-hmm.
and was able to, like, convey a lot of facts as well. But it was ultimately about handling yourself and treating others with respect, I thought. Being competent in your speech, admitting wrong, and accepting defeat in an argument. And it was clear cut, and this is why I said that, like, the racist juror member, like, wasn't even an obstacle for Henry Fonda, nor was the guy that wanted to go to the baseball game.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have the moment of the guy that wanted to go to the baseball game switching his vote to not guilty. And the anger of the European juror member who goes over and asks him why and yells at him isn't because of his differing opinion. It's because he had nothing to substantiate his opinion. He had nothing to say. He was once again, like he was the whole time, just not treating the situation seriously enough. And then you have a character like the stockbroker who comes across as much more mean or stern, and yet he's the quickest to... He's probably the most methodical and certain of his position, and yet he's very quick to admit defeat when his evidence is taken down by Henry Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it just is such a lesson of, like, how to handle yourself in argument. But it also, I think, just showed how important emotion and morals are as well, because I don't think that Lee J. Cobb looks like that bad of a character in this movie, next to a couple of the other characters at the table.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think he's such a strong antagonist, is because, like, a good antagonist you don't know quite how you feel about, because it's pretty clear that he's biased in his opinion, is being stubborn, doesn't actually have a factual argument backing his case.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got these emotions stored up and a personal reason to believe what he believes, and that is way stronger than facts. And it's eventually broken down by Henry Fonda, but it's just, I think, a pretty beautifully done moment of, like, everyone's coming from somewhere.
Mm.
And, like, if they hadn't talked about his kid, if he hadn't opened up about his kid, no one would have known why he was so adamant that this guy should be convicted.
Mm-hmm.
But it was about something personal that he was keeping inside. And it was just great that, like, the way that they broke that down was by, like, treating people with respect. All the characters that come out looking good and all the characters that it literally switches over. Like, characters switch over to not guilty in order of, like, how respectful they are,
mm-hmm.
and how, like, well they handle themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's how it seems to me. And it's like a good thing to take away from. It's like you are so much more likely to think like people that you look up to. And a good person looks up to someone who is ethical and morally good and treats others with respect. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm much more inclined to lean towards someone like Henry Fonda, who's, like, being nice to me than, like, one of the guys that's yelling at me, you know? And mm-hmm. It's tough to watch, like, people on TV yell at each other, mm-hmm. you know? That's something that's been quite present the last few years, is, like,
yeah.
just that sort of attitude. But I don't know where I'm going with this, but, like, there's just a better way. And I think this movie shows, like, it's more important to treat others with love and respect than to think a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, we're all going to think differently because of the way we were brought up, or because of our experiences, or something that happened to us. But that matters a lot less when you're actually treating each other well and treating each other with love.
Yeah. Yeah. And going off that, you know, it's like you said, past few years have just been super crazy. And it seems only as if everyone is digging those differences deeper and further apart from one another. And another reference to the Dale Carnegie book, you know, just hearing people out and hearing what people have to say, you know, of course people have different opinions and people are allowed to have different opinions. And, you know, that's what makes the beauty of, I mean, how boring would everyone be if everyone had the same opinion?
Everyone had the same opinion.
And I think just letting people talk about what they believe, and, you know, maybe I don't necessarily agree with you, but I respect you and I respect what you mm-hmm. believe in. You know, oh boy, do I wish everything could be like that. I don't know. But
I don't think, and I say it's, like, new, like the past couple of years, but that's not true. I don't think this movie would have been made if it was just the past couple of years that I like that, you know.
I would say past few years, because I feel like social media has only amplified everything. Of course, this stuff has been going on forever, but
and I think you and I coming to age and starting to realize these things are present in our lives definitely too helps amplify that. But I don't think it's a problem that's ever going to be solved.
No.
But on an individual level, I think we all have a personal responsibility to, man, do our best to like love people that don't think like us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in your book, you're talking about like, you're acquiring tools to talk to someone and, you know, maybe sway them to your opinion. And that's good. That's like a good thing to learn. But even beyond like trying to convince someone of an argument the way you are in this book, or Henry Fonda is, it's like, even if you're not trying to convince someone of something, just being able to sit with someone who doesn't think the same as you and treating them with love, it can go such a long way, you know?
Right. So definitely,
man, I'm so bad at that. Like, man, I do not treat people with love sometimes just because the way they think, even if that's internalized, even if that's something I see on social media and I, you know,
yeah, definitely
have an internalized feeling about that person. It's not something I ever act out on, but you know, it's just, yeah, it's a really hard thing to do, but it's like a heroic thing in this movie. It's like it's a real deep truth to watch something. And I think that's what makes the movie super powerful, is watching a hero like Henry Fonda's character stand up against like what I think the movie shows of as evil. And, you know, he's just a man. He's just an architect, but you know, does so much with these 11 other guys in this room. It's really powerful.
Yep. And a great quote from the film to leave everyone on: prejudice always obscures the truth. Boom.
Yeah. There it is. That was a good one.
You have anything else? And other stuff, Pod. Really getting deep out here.
Yeah. That's what we want. There's a lot of good quotes in that movie I'm thinking of now. A classic is, he don't even speak good English. He doesn't even speak good English. And the same, the European character has a lot of good lines. He goes, I don't remember what the guy says to him, but he says, like, why are you so polite? Or why are you so, he's like, why are you so polite? And he says, the same reason you're not. It was the way I was brought up. Which is just what we're talking about. It's like, people are going to be different based off the way they are brought up, but the guy is still polite to everyone. And But yeah, that's it from me.
Boom. There it is. I honestly, like, I feel like this conversation has made me appreciate the film more than just after watching it. I feel like this is one of a really good episode. So
yeah, I do
really,
too.
It's really good combo.
Well, it's like, I was thinking about this last night, and you have certain movies that, man, just have such deep set truths in them that make the movie, I think, I'm not trying to act like the short films I've made are anything special, but like the ones that have like a worldwide truth baked into them are more special than like the ones that don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I just showed you one I made about like forgiveness. I think that's more powerful than like some other random movie I make. And I thinking about movies we've watched this semester, it's like so many of the powerful ones, like for me, Pride and Prejudice is powerful because it is about like prejudice and selfishness and like love overcoming that. I would say even like Avengers and Star Wars, in my opinion, they're weaker movies cinematically, but there's, and you and I have talked so much about this on our own time, there's so much power in the fight of good versus evil. That, you know, there's a reason why those movies like get billions of dollars of revenue is because people yearn for that kind of stuff. And subconsciously, there's something that makes us love watching 12 Angry Men, because we know the truth that is baked into this writing and this directing and acting. And it's powerful. It's powerful, and we all need it. It's like the beautiful thing about cinema is like, it's needed in the same way that music is. And yeah, it's
good. Yeah, definitely. Good stuff. And nothing better than Vin Diesel talking about family. Am I right?
Like, honestly, it's like, it's, you think about Fast and Furious, it's all about family. It's like something that we yearn for.
Right.
Man, you're totally right.
Who knew that the Fast and Furious film series would have such a deep connection for all of us?
You know, F10's in development right now.
You're joking. Please just stop making them. I'm done.
Hey, man, they're still doing well. I think it actually did well, F9, opening weekend.
I'm not surprised. People like street car racers. Saving the world.
Fast and Furious.
No, I'm not. I mean, you know, some of them are actually very good. And
just like some of the Marvel movies are very good.
Right. And, you know, nothing better than some streetcar racers saving the world, robbing some millionaires, driving sports cars from skyscraper to skyscraper. You know, normal streetcar racer stuff.
I was watching a podcast with this is just a long episode. Sorry, guys. But I was watching a podcast with like a local director talking. He does like music videos, and short films. And he was just like talking about like since having a kid with his wife that like everything's more emotional. And he was like, man, he's like, it's so weird. I used to never cry in movies, but like I watched Furious 7 and like all the Paul Walker moments just had me like crying so much. It's just like, it's just funny. That's just reminding me of. But anyway,
I'll tell you that ending scene in Furious 7 that gets you every time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great episode. Thank you all for listening. Appreciate you all. We're coming up on a close here on season 4, and we're closing off back to back episodes with back to back guests. Should we reveal?
Are we revealing those yet, or are we waiting?
I think we should reveal the first one now, and then
I'll wait.
Okay, all right. So next week we will be viewing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, classic Quentin Tarantino film, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie, among others.
Kurt Russell.
Yes, Kurt Russell. One of my favorites, I would say. We've actually talked about it on the pod before, back in season 3, when we were reading some Wikipedia pages, giving the most boring stuff ever. Which I also think the little clip that we inserted in that episode, pretty sure that's against the law to do that, but it's okay. But yeah, next episode we'll be viewing that, and our guest will be my brother Cole Massey. Very excited for that one, and it's one of his favorites as well. So we're excited about that, and then we'll have a guest for the last episode as well. But glad that we can incorporate a guest, and I feel like both of these guests have been patiently waiting their turn to be on the pod. So long overdue, I would say. And I think the Tarantino coming in at 19, episode 19, is also long overdue. But you know, better late than ever. So.
All right, guys. Well, I'm excited about Cole coming on and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Hope you guys give it a listen. Thank you for your support thus far. Excited to close out the season. Excited for that last recap episode.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yep.
Thank you for your support, and we'll see you next week.
Peace.